You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 9th to the 15th of November 2017. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined today by Deputy News Editor John Morgan, reporter Ellie Bothwell and Books Editor Matthew Rice. Now, for our cover feature this week, we dispatched Ellie to the Arctic tundra on Canada's Baffin Island, among other places, to find out how Canada is working to get more Aboriginal people into higher education. It's a fascinating read, and she'll bring you some highlights from that piece in just a moment. John has been speaking to former England and Manchester United right-back and failed football manager Gary Neville about his new higher education institution, the University Academy 92. I'm not allowed to let the opportunity to have a go at a Man U player pass as a card-carrying Bolton Wanderers fan myself. Anyway, John will also be bringing us news of the extent to which overseas students in the UK are subsidising the sector's research. And Matthew has been playing computer games, and not just for fun, but also because they're seeking to bring research projects to life. He'll tell us a little bit more about that, and indeed this week's Book of the Week, towards the end of the podcast. But first, Ellie, you've been out on the Arctic tundra learning about Indigenous education.
Yes, and this is sort of kind of main reason for the trip was due to the fact that Canada's universities are sort of really ramping up their efforts to recruit more Indigenous students and Indigenous staff, and to incorporate Indigenous knowledge into the curriculum and into research as well. And it's kind of partly due to the government's Truth and Reconciliation Commission report a couple of years ago, which essentially revealed sort of the ways in which Indigenous people in Canada have been persecuted over the years, and the kind of horrific residential school system that they were kind of forced to go through. And so basically now, you know, universities and other institutions in the country are kind of seeking to atone for those injustices and make sure that Aboriginal people are better represented.
Indeed, an underserved population, and one that's growing as well, one of the fastest growing populations in Canada, I read in your
opinion. Yes, so it is the fastest growing population, and increasingly, you know, a lot of these people would have been based in, you know, kind of very much Indigenous communities, and increasingly, you know, young people are now actually moving to quite big cities where there are lots of non-Indigenous, you know, people there, and then that's causing its own problems. There have been cases of abuse, there have been murders in part of Canada of, you know, in young Indigenous people. So, I mean, the piece really looks at the challenges that universities face in sort of identifying these people, many of whom don't wish to, you know, self-identify as Indigenous. And, you know, a lot of these people, you know, go to high schools where they don't necessarily have the kind of educational background that means it's easy for them to go straight into university. But the article also kind of addresses some of the challenges in kind of convincing academics who aren't Indigenous the value of things like Indigenous knowledge. So I speak to one professor called Frances Widdowson, who's, you know, concerned that actually Indigenous knowledge is more of a spiritual belief rather than, you know, kind of science that we should be incorporating. And she says, you know, you wouldn't kind of Christianize a university or Buddhicize a university, so why should we be incorporating, you know, Indigenous knowledge into academia? So it's a kind of very complex issue.
Yeah, all discussed at great length in that excellent piece. What was it like out there? I suppose that's a question I can ask you now we've got you in person. It was, you know, some of the tweets you sent, it looked a fairly cold and barren place.
Yeah, it was.
This was Baffin Island, I imagine.
Yes, yeah. So, well, I went to Iqaluit. So that's in Baffin Island. That's the capital of Nunavut, which is Canada's northernmost province. There wasn't any snow when I went, so I went at the end of August, and it was just, yeah, quite kind of very rocky, muddy, barren land.
Grey.
Very grey. I mean, it was the kind of almost the warmest time of year, but it was probably about 10 degrees, you know, not many people about at all, you know, no sort of pavements. They have, you know, roads, but just kind of mud on the outside. Went into a few supermarkets where everything was unbelievably expensive. So I mentioned that, you know, a bag of flour costs $15, which is about almost £10. And, you know, there's an Arctic survival store where you can get knives and guns. So it was a very sort of fascinating look at, you know, a place that is just like nowhere I've, you know, ever been before.
Indeed. Well, you can read that piece, which does have plenty of colour in it as well, I should say, in the magazine and indeed on TimesHigherEducation.com. Moving on, back to the news section this week, John. You've been speaking to Gary Neville, England's greatest right-back.
Of course I have. Well, naturally, after, as you put it, Gary Neville's failed venture into football management with Valencia, Sky TV pundit career, hotel industry, property developer. Of course, he's setting up a higher education institution.
Well, it's so easy these days.
As you would. So this is University Academy 92, the 92 referring to the class of 92, who are also involved in this. That's Phil Neville, Paul Scholes, Ryan Giggs, and Nicky Butt, alongside Gary Neville. And they are partnering with Lancaster University, which is going to award the degrees, and technology giant Microsoft is going to offer courses in business, media and sport with character development at the core. Mm-hmm. And I spoke to Gary Neville at a Microsoft event and talked to him about why he wanted to do this and how it's different from a traditional university. He talked about some of the things he learned as a professional footballer, that it's not just your skills, it's resilience that gets you through, as it does in kind of business or journalism. It's not just about what you can do, it's about character. And he also talked about the idea that high performance just comes from wealth being wrong, saying that UA 92 needs to be proof of that. Mm. That ultimately we can make people a success that haven't necessarily got the highest level of academic qualifications or haven't got a wealthy background. So part of the aim is to appeal to a different kind of student who might, compared to the one who might consider a traditional university perhaps. But obviously this is going to have an element of profit as well. You know, the class of 92, they're businessmen. They make a lot of money from their property projects, from their hotel. And we touched on this in the interview, but it is going to be the aim is to make a profit for the class of 92.
Yeah, and he was quite bolshy, wasn't he, in his defence about the role of profit in education. It's not a dirty word, I think he said, or words to that effect.
So I asked him, you know, could there potentially be concerns about profits being made from education? Obviously there are people who worry about that, particularly if the students are coming into the institution with low loans provided by the government. And he replied that, you know, if they wanted to do this, if they want to shift education the way we want it to go, it's got to be a commercially viable operation. Profit is not a dirty word. We shouldn't shy away from it. And he, not surprisingly, referred to the example of property developers being accused of greed, but said actually they contribute to community regeneration, and talked about the way that UA 92, the aim is to regenerate quite a deprived area of Manchester. That's Trafford, near the Manchester United football ground, where the campus is going to be located. Mm. And I also asked him about another element of the UA 92 venture that's raised some questions, which is its use of the word university. Mm. And Gary Neville throughout referred to the institution as a university under the current rules that are still in operation. You would need to have your own degree awarding powers before you could apply to become a university, and UA 92 does not have that, although it has the involvement of Lancaster University. So there have been some questions about the DfE allowing UA 92 to use the word university. Asked Gary Neville about that, and he replied, it is a university. We've got permission from the DfE to be able to use the word university. So There you go,
indeed. Well, you can read that story, of course, in the magazine and online. And the main news story very quickly this week, John, looks at the extent to which international students are subsidising research activities in UK universities. And it's quite a lot.
That's right. This is a report from the Higher Education Policy Institute, and this finds that overseas students in the UK are in effect subsidising research to the tune of £8,000 each. So, as we know, research funding does not cover the full costs of research, all the staff, equipment and indirect things such as use of library and admin services. And Vicky Oliver, postgrad economics student at Oxford, has compiled this report for HEPI, and it finds that over the course of the average degree, £3,800 of the average annual tuition fee paid by international students goes to funding research, adding up to 8k over the course of an average degree. And it urges the government to close an estimated £3.3 billion deficit in research funding, which the report says means that £1 in every £7 spent on research comes from services made from teaching. So, this report is using the upcoming budget, is saying that the upcoming budget should address what's been exposed by this report and get closer to funding the full costs of research. But I'm sure some vice-chancellors might have their quibbles about the HEPI report using the word cross-subsidies. I mean, a lot of people might argue that overseas students aren't offering a subsidy. They're just contributing to, research is part of what makes British universities great. Why shouldn't overseas students make their contribution towards the cost of it?
It is what they're buying into, arguably, after all that reputation.
I'm sure some people make that
argument. Yeah, and more online this week about similar subjects. Noise from inside the Home Office that international students could be removed from net migration figures. We've covered that online. There's also a blog from HEPI's Nick Hillman online too, covering that issue as well. Before we go, though, while Ellie and John Matthew have been hard at work, you've been playing computer games.
Yeah, it's easy life. Yes, this is the competition called Developing Beyond, which is organised by the Wellcome Trust and Epic Games. And it's basically a competition for games which incorporate genuine scientific research. And so it's basically games developers have got together with academics to develop their games. And there were about 100 submissions, and the three which were shortlisted were being demonstrated as work in progress. And Cambridge researchers are digging up a cemetery, a medieval cemetery in Cambridge, which they came across during some building work, investigating the Black Death. And a games developer approached them, and he created a game which he described as a narrative exploration game in the style of supernatural English folk horror.
And well-known styles.
And basically you start and you're sort of walking down a rural Sussex landscape, and suddenly you slip through a portal into the past and become a herbalist, Agnes the herbalist at the time of the Black Death. And then at that later stage, you go back and you become a priest who's telling off Agnes the herbalist for using all these superstitious methods and so on.
And who's it aimed at? I mean, there is a serious point here. I suppose this is using research to make something quite engaging, quite accessible. Who do they envisage playing these games?
Well, I think the researchers on the whole were absolutely adamant that the crucial thing was that the game should be playable. They had to be playable and exciting and dramatic. And most of the judges were essentially judging, they were all enthusiastic gamers, I think, and were judging them on that basis. There was another one about seeds, which is about how you mix different plants together if you want to create a plant that's frost resistant and so on. And the games developer thought he would do something very high tech. And then he met this researcher who's been looking at the history of this, and there are people who are doing this kind of thing in their potting shed and in a very amateurish way, and scraping radium off their watches to make radioactive material to irradiate plants with. So the whole aesthetic of the game is like a sort of 50s decrepit shed. And I've never done virtual reality games before, and I was utterly amazed by how gripping it was.
Would you play again?
I would, yes.
And before we go, very quickly, Matthew, in your role of books editor, of course, this week's book of the week, what have we got this week?
This is science writer John Turney looking at a book called A History of the Future, Prophets of Progress from H.G. Wells to Isaac Asimov by Peter J. Bowler, which is, as the title suggests, about predictions of what the future would be like and whether how far they've come about. As there was somebody wrote a book quite recently, sort of compilation of this called "Where's My Jetpack?" And of course, a lot of these things about flying cars and martinis served by robot butlers haven't actually happened. But it's quite interesting to look at the past and see, what might happen, and to reflect on whether our own predictions are more likely.
Indeed. I actually wrote a piece of musical theatre at university about H.G. Wells' Time Machine novel, but the less said about that, the better, I suspect. Anyway, you'll read about all of the stories in this week's podcast, and much more besides, but thankfully not that ill-advised foray into musical theatre, on the Times Higher Education website, timeshighereducation.com. You'll also find us on Twitter at Times Higher Ed, on LinkedIn, and on Facebook too. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.